Full Story is supported by AMP Super. There are moments in life where everything shifts. A new job, a new home, a new direction. But those same moments can also shape your future. AMP calls these super moments. Times to check in on your super. And with 24/7 digital financial advice, AMP Super helps you make more confident decisions as your situation changes. Search AMP Super Moments to find out more. AMP Super. Built for life's super moments. AMP Super, issued by NM Superannuation Proprietary Limited. See PDS and TMD on amp.com.au and consider what's right for you.
This is The Guardian.
I'm in the Oval Office and we're in a fight against the worst congressman in the history of our country. His name is Thomas Massie. He's from Kentucky. I hope you're going to put him out of business tomorrow. He is so bad.
I'm Regid Ahmed.
And I'm Jonathan Yaroshelmi.
And this is Decoding America, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Donald Trump has succeeded in putting Thomas Massie out of business, but Massie isn't a politician from across the aisle. He's a fellow Republican that Donald Trump turned against.
We are breaking in live coverage for this news. Tom Massie, the conservative Kentucky candidate,
has finally
he gone. Reportedly, not apparently, reportedly.
This election in Kentucky is just one of hundreds that are taking place across America at the moment, but it is representative of a huge split that is emerging within Trump's base. So while, yes, we'll be talking about politics, I also want to try and answer a question that has bothered me for years. Does Donald Trump write his own tweets?
Straight from the horse's mouth. When you see it on Truth Social, you know it's directly from President Trump. That's the beauty of this president and his transparency and relaying this administration's policies to all of you and to the rest of the world.
Beauty of this president and his transparency. We're going to talk a lot more about social media posting as Trump posts up a storm late at night. But before we go to that, Jonathan, he gone, as we heard. Just as we came into the studio, Thomas Massie, he's a sitting Republican congressman who was running in the Republican primary for the midterms, and he's lost the big campaign. So let's just start by figuring out who is Thomas Massie and why Donald Trump hates him so much.
And maybe why we care about his tiny Kentucky race 6 months before the midterms here in Australia.
True.
Well, Thomas Massie's been in Congress since 2012. He's a libertarian, so he's kind of very pro-small government. He's very pro-gun rights, very anti-abortion. He sounds like someone Donald Trump would get on
with,
frankly.
Pretty far to the right in terms of the spectrum we would understand.
Yeah, that's right. But he has been a consistent thorn in Trump's side this last year. He voted against Trump's signature tax and spend bill, the big, beautiful bill, because he thought it would add too much to the country's debt, which does. He has been insisting on congressional oversight for Trump's military action in Venezuela and Iran. He thinks that the Congress should approve things like that. And probably most importantly, he has been a key figure, maybe the main figure, in forcing the US Justice Department to release the Epstein files.
I wonder if some of this reaction gives us an idea of how much this election has centered around Donald Trump, because Stephen Chung, the White House communications director, in a social media post on our blog said, "Do not ever doubt President Trump and his political power. F around, find out."
Yeah, I mean, it's unusual that we would focus on a congressional primary this much. And the reason we're doing it is because it's emblematic of Trump's power within the party, but also of this kind of schism that is happening within the Republican Party and Trump's base. These primaries, they're an opportunity for voters to determine which candidates will run in the midterm elections. So normally, right, you know, in Australia, for instance, when we go to vote in elections, whether they're state elections, federal elections, the candidates are there. They're decided by the party in some sort of internal backroom deals.
And people who are already sitting are often pre-selected anyway. It's very unusual to have someone who's a sitting MP then disendorsed by their party.
Exactly. But in America, what happens generally is that there's a primary. So voters, often tens of thousands of voters, Republicans, Democrats, can vote for who's going to be on the ticket. And so you see these things where Republicans and Democrats can go up against each other in quite vicious campaigns, like this campaign has been really, really vicious. And what's really unusual about this campaign is the money. So typically a primary election You know, a candidate might spend $100,000, $200,000. They might spend nothing if they're going up unopposed because they want to save that money for the actual election in 6 months' time when they're facing a Democrat. This primary election, remember, two Republicans facing off against each other, the money is close to $35 million.
That's just for one, as you say, a little race in Kentucky, because Tuesday has been a really busy primary election day. It's all hotting up for the midterms. Six states across several time zones have had their primaries, and this is just one. $35 million just for Kentucky.
Just one for one tiny seat in Kentucky.
There's no money left for anything else. You mentioned that it can get pretty nasty. Let's just listen to an example of how nasty it got from Thomas Massie's side. This is the guy that's lost it. It gets into a bit of gutter politics. Just for anyone who's listening, there's some homophobic views in this clip.
Gowron doesn't share our Kentucky values. He is with the weirdos. And if Gowron wins, the weirdos take over. On May 19th, say no to woke Eddie Gowron and his billionaire club of LGBTQ weirdos. Re-elect Thomas Massie for Kentucky, for America.
We didn't play all of it. It does get pretty offensive. But it gives you the idea of how gutter politics this all got. Trump went low. He didn't go high. He went low, low, low.
Yeah, so we heard from Thomas Massie then. He was making accusations about a, you know, that ad was making accusations about a donor who was funding his opponent. Donald Trump himself has been incredible. He's been making comments about Thomas Massie's wife. He's also accused Massie of getting married too quickly after his first wife died in 2024. Sort of really rude things, frankly.
How much is this about Donald Trump removing anyone from the party who has independent thought in any way?
Yeah, I think that goes to the heart of it. This is about Trump's iron grip on the Republican Party, because last week, Indiana had their own primaries and they were looking for Republicans to stand in their state senate. So not in Washington, in the Indiana state senate. And those state senators, seven of them had refused to redraw a map in Trump's favor. We've been talking about this fight over the redistricting. And seven Republicans refused to do it. Five of those Republicans lost their primaries after Donald Trump campaigned against them. Trump intervened in Louisiana's primary, so a kind of senator there, Bill Cassidy, he's been in the Senate for a while. He's not going to be running this year because Donald Trump turned against him because Bill Cassidy 6 years ago voted to impeach Donald Trump after the January 6th insurrection. Just today, Donald Trump has endorsed a challenger to Texas Senator John Cornyn. John Cornyn has been in the Senate for 24 years. He's a kind of really established Republican face there. He is now not going to be running because Donald Trump decided to go with someone else because a few years ago, John Cornyn questioned whether Trump was a politically viable candidate. He's voted with Trump ever since then. He's been a supporter, but that wasn't enough for Trump. So they're now using the word primary as a threat. They're saying, you know, turn against me. I'm going to primary you. It's become this really vicious campaign. And David Axelrod, who's a Democratic strategist, he said, when people ask why so many Republicans stick with Trump, even if that means going against their long-held principles, these results provide the answer. It's about survival.
So one by one, we see these people who have stood up to Donald Trump at any point, really, even in a small way, basically get primaried. Can we call that a verb?
Yeah, you'll have to do the grammar for me. I'm not so good on
call
that.
Call it a verb.
But yeah, it's
get taken out.
That seems to be the way it's doing it. And for quite sort of anodyne things in some cases, like things that you question why they would do that. And in the case of sort of John Cornyn, this senator in Texas, for instance, I think there are a lot of Republicans really angry that Trump has chosen not to endorse him and has endorsed someone else, because that means that they have an established senator there who Republicans in Texas seem to like. And now potentially they'll be voting for someone else. And this is going to be a much more expensive campaign for the Republicans because they've got to introduce the state to a new figure.
We are seeing people like Lindsey Graham and other Republicans saying basically the message is if Trump doesn't endorse you, your political career is over. And I noticed a quote from a White House advisor. Some of this language to me is still not normalized. It's still pretty shocking. But they're saying this is basic political management of a party. You have to keep everybody on the reservation. Occasionally, you have to shoot a hostage. The next one is Thomas Massie. That's how they see it.
Yeah, and then the question is, what does the Republican Party look like going forward if it is just the party of Trump? Donald Trump himself has said in the past, you know, MAGA, the Make America Great Again movement, isn't about any single ideology. It's just about him. So does the Republican Party just become a party of people who are blindly following him? But what we're seeing is that there is this split within the movement And Thomas Massie represents one side of that and Donald Trump represents another.
So the MAGA base, are they still on Donald Trump's side? Because you're seeing really low opinion polling for Donald Trump. He's generally not that well liked amongst the electorate.
Except among his base. He continues to be loved by his base, but I think even among the broader Republican Party, there are some questions. So Thomas Massie represents those things we talked about. He represents the America First policy. Don't do foreign wars. Don't do foreign intervention. Just worry about what's happening in America. He represents small government. Don't get us into loads of debt. And perhaps most importantly, he represents an increasingly large wing of the Republican Party, which is suspicion of America's relationship with Israel. And the war in Iran has brought this all into relief because this is a war that the US entered with Israel. Thomas Massie has been hugely critical of Israel, like other figures like Tucker Carlson, the former Fox News host, who is now, you know, what would we call him, a conservative influencer or something like that. And more Republicans share that view that we shouldn't be tying ourselves so closely to Israel.
So if there's this sort of split emerging, there's still a lot of support for Donald Trump in the base. But once Donald Trump is gone, what kind of Republican Party will we have left? And what does that mean for the Democrats?
So in terms of what Republican Party will have left, I guess it's a choice between Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance. That's kind of a very simplistic way of viewing it. But I think in a lot of people's minds, those two people are the main candidates for 2028 at the moment. A lot can change in 2 years. And Marco Rubio represents maybe the more traditional wing of the Republican Party, more happy to go into wars. We know that he was kind of keener on the Iran war, more happy to partner with Israel. And J.D. Vance perhaps represents that America First bent. So he's still very popular amongst figures like Tucker Carlson. We know he had a lot of suspicions about entering the war in Iran, and we know that he is someone who has criticized the relationship with Israel in the past, not so much now. But for anyone from that wing, they're going to face challenges. So Thomas Massie, for instance, you know, we've talked about the amount of money that was spent in this election. So much of that came from the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. This is this kind of group that is a pro-Israel interest group, essentially. They've spent over $9 million just in this one Kentucky race. They've got a huge amount of money to throw around. So anyone that kind of threatens that relationship with Israel, they are going to spend as much money as possible to make sure that they're de-seated.
So we still could see this very narrowly defined Republican Party after Donald Trump. But just very briefly, Democrat Pete Buttigieg said, look, this is an opportunity for us. You know, we can take the space Republicans are leaving behind, especially as Donald Trump has low popularity. But doesn't that mean the Democrats would just have to move to the right?
Well, not necessarily. I think that what we see is that same split that's happening in the Republican Party over relations with Israel, that's also happening with the Democrats. I think a few years ago, polling showed us most Americans favored or had a more favorable view of Israel than the Palestinians. In the last year, that's flipped. So now more Americans have a more favorable view of the Palestinians than Israel. So it means that for any party, they're going to have to tread a very careful line when it comes to relations with Israel.
Okay, well, watch this space to see how those primaries leading into the midterms go. A lot of the attacks that Donald Trump did were on his social media posts. So let's talk about that. We have spoken about this before in terms of seeing all these late night spree of posts happening. I mean, quite a lot of them, 50 sometimes in one night, roughly.
Yeah, so the day before he flew out to China last week, he posted more than 50 times in a three-hour period overnight. And these were kind of quite random things. Attacks on Barack Obama, demands that political opponents be arrested, conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, I think doctored images of himself on the $100 bill, just a kind of random stream of things. And since the start of his second term, I looked this up, there's been some analysis done on this, and he's posted close to 9,000 times on Truth Social. A lot of that happening late at night, early in the morning, all while Americans are asleep and very little of it getting much coverage. And the Daily Beast found that given the president's volume of Truth Social posts published between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., there were only 5 days in April where he could have gotten a full night's sleep if he was posting them all himself.
Do we know how it works? Is he sitting in bed with his phone tapping them out?
So I've wondered about this for years because Donald Trump is such a unique social media presence, isn't he? And his loyalists always try to make it clear that he writes his own tweets. He's authentic. And Twitter was such a key part of his finding an audience, of his political ascendancy. It's obviously Truth Social now. He was kicked off Twitter after the January 6th attempted insurrection. So we should probably be calling them truths or something
like that. I don't know, but we still call them tweets, and a lot of people still
do. Let's just call them tweets for the sake of sanity. So he has such a unique style in the way he does it as well. Lots of words in all caps, quite random and sort of enthusiastic use of punctuation. There's a lot of strange inconsistencies in which words are capitalized and which aren't. And there's a real tone to them because when you read them, you can hear him saying them.
Yes.
And I guess I'm not the only person who's wondered whether he's, you know, knocking out all of these tweets dozens of times a day. Because reporters from Wired looked at this last year and they spoke to people inside the White House and found that 95% of the time he isn't typing out his own posts. So 5% of the time, according to these people in the White House, he is. But most of the time, he has a system.
I mean, we heard Caroline Levitt right at the top there, and she was saying this is policy. When you see a social media post, and even if Trump is contradicting everything the White House is saying, I'm assuming that's what she meant, that is the US government policy.
Yeah, and that's part of the concern, because so much of what comes out on that Truth Social platform, as well as the memes and the AI pictures, are things that are hugely important to the global economy, to the war in Iran, to all these things. He's announcing these things via that platform. And so this system through which these things are written and appear on our social media feeds is really important. And the reason we know about it is because during one of his trials in 2024, a former aide of his, this woman, Madeleine Westerhout, she took the stand and she was giving evidence. She was actually asked about how his tweets come to be. And she said, you know, she had a desk right outside the Oval Office and he would call her in during the first term and he would dictate a tweet essentially and she would write it down and then she would leave. She would type it up. She would print it out. She would take it back to him in the Oval Office. He would then edit it by hand with a biro or a Sharpie. And she said there were certain words he insisted were always capitalized, like country.
So he's even saying capitalize that.
Capitalize this. He would tell her to add in more exclamation points random bits of punctuation. She said he was a big fan of the Oxford comma, perhaps a bit surprising. It's just such an incredibly cumbersome process.
It's cumbersome. It's very old school. We actually have a clip to get a sense of how it works. Because in 2024, Fox News did a documentary series called Art of the Surge on Trump's campaign against Kamala Harris.
He said these are the things of which he complains. The things of which he complains.
And you can see Trump dictating his posts to another woman who we'll talk about in a moment. And you can hear mad typing in the background.
Ready? These prosecutions were all started by her and Biden against their political opponent. Me. Get that out right away.
So he's dictating a tweet there, and the person he's dictating to is one Natalie Hupp.
Yes, Natalie Hupp, his new executive assistant. She's a 35-year-old. She used to be an anchor on a conservative news channel. She now works for Trump. And Wall Street Journal did some brilliant reporting about this last week, trying to kind of get inside this process. And they found that she would bring him stacks of draft social media posts that she'd printed out. These are just memes that she'd found online.
She's known as the human printer. Like I read that she carries around a printer.
Because he has to approve them all by hand. Apparently he refuses to read things off a screen. And so she's bringing all these kind of memes and things she's printed out and he would give them the okay. And then she would just log onto his account and post batches of them, often, you know, outside work hours, in the middle of the night. She reportedly was behind that AI-generated image of him as Christ that we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yep.
And she's really frustrated a lot of people in the White House because she's doing this and going around a lot of the power brokers. So she's going around the chief of staff, the national security advisors, and she's saying, I work for Trump. I only listen to Trump. And so she's just posting all this stuff with very little oversight from the wider White House.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal did say that, as you say, there's that frustration that other chiefs of staff can't check it. And the response in there from the White House communications director, Stephen Chung, same guy we talked about earlier, was just, we don't discuss internal deliberations on how the process works. But no other social media tool has been more effective than Truth, end quote. So he didn't quite answer the question there.
No, he didn't. And I'm sure this continues to be a massive frustration for them because we've talked about this before. When he is making these announcements about the Strait of Hormuz, when he's making these announcements about the state of the negotiations with Iran in this war, Who's overseeing it? Is it just this woman, Natalie Harp? Are they just talking about it together?
It's Donald Trump. I mean, he's approving it, basically.
And then what do the Pentagon do? What do the Secretary of State do? Do they just follow what he says? We just don't understand the process for these announcements. And while, yes, a lot of it is just silly memes, AI-generated things, a lot of it is really important to national security and to the world economy.
You got that sense from Caroline Levitt there. They pivot. If he puts out a post that contradicts existing policy, they just move towards it.
That does seem to be the case. I guess we'll never know, but I'm just glad that we have a better idea of how this process works now, because to me, it just seems crazy.
Let's go to a break. When we come back, more fascinating stories coming out of the White House. But Donald Trump has dropped a $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS, but what did he get in return?